Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the Damage Report Lockdown Edition, where we are dealing with new tech problems that crop up every single day. But hopefully this is broadcasting. You can see me and hear me, and soon I'll be able to see you as well. Me, but also, by the way, Jordan Yule, who joins us now. How's it going, Jordan?
Hey, I'm doing well, John. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm good. We were just talking just before we went live, and I'll give everyone who's joined the chat now, I'll give you a preview of what we're going to be talking about in the show in just a little bit, about how all of these TV shows are having to adapt to, like, almost on a dime, turning to filming from home. And it has been interesting to see which ones are weathering that change better than others.
Right, yeah, we're seeing who can make the jump and who's kind of more, which studios are in shows and institutions are more scrappy than others. But the show's like, you know, TYT is ready to go. This is the moment where you all kind of like rise and lead the way. You folks in the Twitch streamers, I feel like, are like made for this moment.
Okay, Jordan, I know you've been following the news on coronavirus. It's obviously been a gigantic issue. And I thought we would jump into it with some of the tough questioning that Trump has been getting recently over testing. You ready to go?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's try anyway.
Yeah.
And by the way, for everybody in the chat right now, hopefully more people will migrate over from the first one. It is very possible that the live viewership of this is going to be much lower because of all the issues. But if you can like and share the stream, that will definitely help us to make sure that as many people know that this is where we're actually at. And yeah, generally the Damage Report is reporting on damage outside of our show. It's a little bit more internally focused today. Anyway, okay, everybody. Donald Trump has been facing some tough questions at his little press conference slash rallies. And one came again from Yamiche Alcindor, who asked him about the fact that we are still lagging behind in our testing per capita. Here is that question and his response.
President, you've said several times that the United States has ramped up testing. Just talk a little quicker or a little louder. Mr. President, you said several times that the United States has ramped up testing, but the United States is still not testing per capita as many people as other countries like South Korea. Why is that? And when do you think that that number will be on par with other countries?
Yeah, well, it's very much on par. Per capita, we have areas of country that's very wide. I know South Korea better than anybody. It's a very tight. Do you know how many people are in Seoul? Do you know how big the city of Seoul is? 38 million people. That's bigger than anything we have. 38 million people.
So anyway, he was asked there why, okay, we've ramped up the testing that we've done, at least in places like New York. There's still wide sections of the country where testing is not being done at nearly those levels. But per capita, we're still lagging behind South Korea. And he said, well, you don't know anything about South Korea. I know about South Korea. You know how many people are in South Korea? In the city of Seoul, 38 million people, which I'm assuming you will be shocked to find out is not true.
Yeah. No, yeah, this is... He likes to go after her, too. Yamiche has been pretty good at holding him accountable throughout this whole crisis. And Trump is just kind of, you know, lying his way through it, trying to, I don't know if it's like imposter syndrome or what, but he's just like trying to just make up stuff as he goes. This is another instance where we are clearly behind the rest of the world, but they're trying to convince everyone outside of Trump's inner circle that, you know, they're actually leading the way. And you can compare like curves from other countries around the world, and countries like South Korea and Japan have really done a great job at flattening the curve. And that's through preventative testing, testing a much larger per capita average of the population, and also like social measures, like staying at home and addressing this at the onset. They understood this is a real crisis. This is something Trump did not do. And now we're kind of like trying to play catch up, but like, it's kind of too late. It's going to start to spread because they didn't do this at the onset.
Yeah, and I think if he had taken this seriously from the very beginning, if he had provided actual leadership in aiding states that need it and providing guidance to the states and cities to make sure that they're abiding by the same sorts of social distancing policies that thankfully some of the big cities and states have been doing for some time, then I think a lot of people, regular people, but also people in the media, would be willing to give him more of a pass on some of this stuff. But he has been. He's been denying that it was serious as weeks and weeks and weeks went by. And so now when he's claiming that we're not only doing the most testing, but we're doing the best testing. He keeps saying that people in South Korea are telling him, we love your tests. Your tests are amazing. We can't trust any of that sort of praise because he's constantly praising himself. We don't know what it's founded on. But we do know two things. One, that we are still lagging behind other countries on per capita testing. I'll have those numbers in just a second. But the second thing that we know is that Seoul does not have 38 million people. Seoul proper has a population of 10 million. The greater metropolitan area is the second largest in the world at around 25 million, which is significant, but still lower than 38 million. But people, they have come up with a theory as to how he ended up with that number. And so it turns out that if you Google Seoul, what you get is this, and it has the elevation listed at 38M, which is not millions of people. It would be meters. We don't know for sure if that's how he ended up with this number, but that's about as much research as I can really imagine him doing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a cursory Google search by him or someone in his team. If we just saw yesterday also at this conference, he didn't have medical experts there. He had Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy. So it seems like he's even keeping people who could disprove his claims at arm's length. There was an incident a couple days ago where someone wanted Dr. Fauci from the CDC to answer a question, and Trump insisted, no, I could talk about it. And his answer was just a lie. It was about like their responsiveness and their readiness for this crisis. So this is just another example of it. And because I think he's so defensive, I think ultimately he knows he's doing a terrible job, but he could never admit that. And because he's operating from this place of defensiveness, he's using this same type of attack tactics to insult and denigrate Yamiche.
He likes going after her. She's the Acosta of 2020 so far. He loves attacking her. He's obsessive in the details about her career, where she's worked before, where she's working now, all that stuff. I wish that he was as focused on the response to coronavirus as he was on the personal and career, the careers of the people who were asking him questions. I'm glad that you brought up the MyPillow guy, because that was an embarrassing moment for our country, that during this incredibly important press conference, or at least hypothetically important, it's become like rallies, which is why, we don't do live. We take bits that we want to talk about and we use it. But like, the guy comes up to promote his business. And it seems like do we have any faith? Is there any reason to believe that when he decides, okay, here are the companies I'm going to boost, and like Roche or whatever, he talks about that quite frequently, like that he or his friends aren't investing in these companies, then doing the press conference, and obviously these things are going to spike the some of the drugs that he's talked about, those companies that have been manufacturing them, they've spiked. Like, do any of us think that this is anything more than meant to boost his approval ratings and possibly make him and his inner circle a little bit of money in the short run? That's what it feels like as an outsider.
Right. I mean, this is just crony capitalism in the White House. Mike Lindell, what they initially claimed and what people ran with was that he was making and manufacturing N95 masks, which is not true. Those are like highly sophisticated and way more protective. What he's doing is making cotton masks, which that's an admirable effort, but so are like a bunch of hobbyists on Etsy. So it was ultimately because of this, it was ultimately just a way for him to promote someone who flatters him, a Republican linked business owner, CEO, a multimillionaire. This is a way, Trump can look like he's working with the business community, because he was also on the receiving end of a lot of criticism around the name of the act escapes me, but it basically empowers him to direct companies to make things in times of national crisis. Exactly. And, he was just getting hammered for that. So here he is doing nothing because this guy's making like cotton masks for publicity. And then he kind of can assuage criticism around what he is doing or not doing around the Defense Production Act.
Yeah. And for those of you at home who want to know, you know, how we're doing in per capita testing, this is as of Saturday, at least. But the U.S. population is around 327 million, which means about one in 366 people are getting tested. For comparison, Italy has a population of about 60 million and has done approximately 454,000 tests, meaning one in 133 people are being tested there, about three times more per capita than in the U.S. Nobody bring up Italy to Trump. He's been studying South Korea. You can't just go bring up a new country to him. But it is an issue. It's an issue in that even with the ramping up of testing, which has happened over the past few weeks, that's a good thing that should have happened more than a month ago, possibly 2 months ago. There's still reason to believe that in a lot of the parts of the country, they're not testing a lot of people who have it. I mean, we can look at like the current numbers of those who are infected, but those are obviously not accurate. The only question is how out of whack they are with the actual number. Is it, you know, that there are twice as many people as we think? Are there five? Are there 10? Are there 20 times as many people? We already know that the problem is bad. Today, we will pass Italy plus China in infections, I believe, or at least current infections. But we'll see. I mean, once these big rural areas finally start getting access to testing, once people have the ability to get tested, we'll know, you know, how far we've lagged behind this entire time.
Right. And this really highlights the flaws of the American healthcare system, too, because healthcare delivery and outcomes in rural areas already lag behind. Because, you know, when you have the profit motive directing these institutions, there's no real incentive for them to go out into sparsely populated rural areas and build a nice state-of-the-art healthcare facility, because the return on investment just isn't there for them. So when you have people treating healthcare as a business, that's... that's the end result. So now we see how that manifests in a time of a global health crisis. It's important to remember as we deal with this collectively that everyone should be treated equal in a healthcare system. Everyone should have the same standard of care. Like that shouldn't be an outlandish, extreme concept. So I do hope people understand that. I'm sure your viewers do. But I just really hope we all take this moment as we get through this together. More people understand that, you know, we would be in a much better position and also to protect ourselves from future crises if we do have universal healthcare.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, for those of you in the chat right now, Anna Kasparian, her latest op-ed for The Hill is live now, and it has to do with this, that it's revealing not new problems that have cropped up in our healthcare system as a result of coronavirus, but the fact that it was set up to fail under a crisis like this. I'm hoping... one of the biggest things I've been hoping is that hypothetically we come out of this with the momentum necessary to fundamentally change the way healthcare, health insurance is dealt with in this country. But the powers that be they're doing everything they can to distract people with misinformation, to, you know, sort of placate them with temporary relief. And right now, with the direction that the Democratic primary is going in, which we're going to talk about later on, the single best opportunity we have to set up a system that will be more resilient in the face of international pandemics like this, right now, it looks like they're successfully warding him off.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Hey
Since the beginning of this coronavirus pandemic, both Donald Trump and Fox News have been reliable sources for unreliable information about the disease, about the response. Now, some of those sources, like Sean Hannity, have backed off of some of the myths that they were spreading. They've been shamed or just guilted into doing the right thing. But that does not mean that if you are an avid watcher of Fox, you're not getting massive amounts of misinformation still. I want you to take a look at this clip from one of the shows on Fox, Diamond and Silk on Live, that we very rarely talk about in this show, but they are openly questioning the official coronavirus death count in a way that I think could lead to more people being killed. Let's take a look.
In a matter of 2 weeks, mm-hmm. over 1,000 people supposedly died from the coronavirus. In a 2 weeks time period, over 1,000 people, after being tested positive, have died from the coronavirus. But it took 39 days from January all the way up to February the 29th, I believe.
That's Saturday. For the first person to die.
Here's another thing.
Come on.
Here's another thing. My president said on March the 24th, Tuesday, this past week, my president said that he would love America to be back up and running.
I knew this was going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
I knew after he said this was going to happen. Go ahead.
At the time he said it, there was 25,489 cases with 307 deaths. Instantaneously, you had the media calling President Trump out. He wanted open by Easter. He wants this open by Easter. Me and you were talking. I said, now watch the numbers of deaths go up.
Right.
Watch everything increase, because they wanted to make it, want to make it look bad.
That's right.
In front of our eyes.
So what they were saying was it took like 39 days for the first death. And in the past few days, thousands of people have died. And that is not evidence that this is a serious pandemic. That is evidence that the numbers are being falsified. And they specifically said that when Trump said he wanted to reopen the economy, whatever that means, on Easter, then all of a sudden the numbers start to go up. And so this is the media or the doctors or the opposition politicians. They are making up these deaths to make Trump look bad and hurt him, and that you should not trust the numbers that are being listed as dead right now.
Well, I mean, if any of your viewers know how exponential growth works, that's exactly why this is so dangerous. And that's exactly why we saw this sudden uptick. I'm sure they're well aware. This is just epidemiologists and experts in infectious diseases have been warning about this. That's why this is so dangerous. That's why people at the onset were saying, please stay inside, please help flatten the curve, because this is exactly what it does. But it's cracking me up this week, because these people who are trying to claim that it's you know, we're inflating the death numbers here, we're inflating the infection count here to make Trump look bad, are at the same time arguing that China is intentionally keeping their numbers low. So it's a problem in China somehow, but it's not a problem here. I cannot reconcile those two things. The cognitive dissonance there is just astounding.
Yeah, I mean, so like I said in the beginning, some of them, like Sean Hannity, now he's like tripping over himself to present himself as someone that takes us seriously. He broadcast his show yesterday or last night from like the dock with the hospital ship Comfort in the background, because he's taking it seriously when he was calling it, you know, a myth and it was being made up by the media just literally weeks ago. They want to present themselves as taking it seriously, but they also want to present it as Trump has protected you from this. He's doing a great job. But those things are inevitably going to butt up against each other, and it's going to be difficult for some of them to present sort of a narrative that can be followed that fits in that very narrow line there. Diamond and Silk, I don't generally watch them. I don't generally care what they think about politics, but I know that they're very popular on the right. Their live shows are very popular. Trump has endorsed them multiple times and brought them to his rallies. And think about, if you're on Fox Nation and you're watching that show, you see what you trust them. You believe them. They're talking about the fake news. So we just hit, let me see the numbers. We've got more than 12,000 new cases reported today. We've passed 3,400 dead, more than 9/11, more than Hurricane Maria, a gargantuan number of people, or at least that's what the hospitals say. Who can actually say? Who knows for sure? So if that number gets to 10,000 dead or 50 or 100,000 dead, and you're a fan of Diamond and Silk, what are you going to think about that number? Are you going to believe that Trump has done a bad job, that the response was inadequate, or is it just more propaganda?
So yeah, I mean, there's a couple things at play here. First, we have to remember early reports, as this was starting to emerge in the United States, there were early reports that Trump was intentionally trying to withhold testing and slow roll medical response because he was worried that a high infection count and a death toll would impact his electability chances in November. So that is the lens through which he is operating and sees this whole crisis. And when you have people like Hannity and Diamond and Silk cheerleading him every step of the way, like they're not there to provide objective commentary. They're there just to defend his every move. And I think it's going to be disastrous when we look back retroactively at what they did. I think Fox News is totally on the hook and liable for misleading millions of people about the severity of this crisis. That is extremely dangerous. So I'm certain my former colleagues at Media Matters are recording every single thing that they say on Fox about coronavirus, and we'll fight them tooth and nail on that, because they need a pound of flesh for what they did.
Yeah, and in the same way, there's been some great ads of Trump statements, you know, like sort of mashed up against the number of infections, but people are going to put those together for Sean Hannity as well, and Laura Ingraham, and you know, Trish Regan's gone now, but you could throw her into that too. Like Fox, yeah. I know, so I said recently that Sean Hannity apparently is backtracking, and he seems like he must feel guilty. And a lot of people responded to that post saying he has no ability to feel guilt. But I wonder, like, now that he sees the numbers of people who are dying, he knows what he said. Does he feel bad? Does he feel like that was a dereliction of his duty to his audience? Did he abuse them, making it more likely that they would not shelter at home, that they would, you know, not take this seriously? Like, some people will have become infected. Some people will die as a result of this. There's a reason people are still packing the beaches and are still packing churches in some areas. It's because the media that they go to for their knowledge about the world has told them that this is, yeah, maybe China's got it bad, but it's really just the media's hyping this thing up, and they want to hurt the economy. Like, do you want to be a part of that? Do you want to be part of this left-wing plot to hurt Donald Trump? I wonder. I will never know, but I wonder if he does feel guilt for what he did, if all of them do.
Right. For a lot of people, there's this invincible mentality, like this, it can't happen to me type approach. And I think that's because I've been thinking about this a lot lately. And I think it's just because we and our generation specifically, we really haven't felt a collective struggle here. Sure, you know, 2008, the financial crisis was pretty severe, but it was nothing compared to like the Great Depression or, you know, the pandemic in 1920. So the older generations had that sort of collectivism because they went through some pretty tough times at the early 20th century. But you know, the boomers, Gen Xers, millennials really haven't had that same type of struggle. Wars haven't been fought here like there are the rest of the world, like throughout the rest of the world. 9/11 was like was pretty catastrophic, but it wasn't like a nationwide thing. It was pretty isolated, and then the response we were totally detached from through jingoism and imperialism. So we don't have that sort of reference point. But now we're starting to live through it, but people cannot accept it. Life has been pretty good for millennials and Gen Xers for the most part. They really haven't had any sort of huge, colossal setbacks like this. So this is the first time people are starting to reconcile with it and deal with it. And I think they're just in the denial stage. But for so many people, and I think we might see this with Sean Hannity and some of these cheerleaders on the right, issues like this don't really impact, like they don't sympathize with these issues until it impacts them directly. And I think we saw a slight turn from Trump in his press conference yesterday, where he talks about a friend who has it now. And his tone and demeanor was totally different than how he's talked about it in the past. So I think maybe once it impacts these people directly, they'll start to take it seriously.
You know, that's interesting. I didn't see that section of it. I'm going to have to go and look for that. Yeah, and people in the media, like we're going to be talking later about Cuomo, like there are producers and things like that. Like people at these networks, they're going to know people who get it. It's a lot harder to imply that it's not serious when people you know are getting sick and potentially dying. One of the sets of crises that we have been anticipating is when coronavirus begins to run rampant through detention facilities. We've already seen that Rikers has an explosion of cases. More than 3% of the individuals currently locked up are apparently infected with coronavirus. But any number of ICE detention facilities are also potential grounds for big spreads of this. And The Intercept did a great job in doing sort of a video chat with a number of women who were being held in one of these ICE detention facilities in Louisiana. And with that video, they were able to tell the story of what's happening to them in a format that has become quite popular during the coronavirus. So take a look at some of this video. So around that time, the video gets broken up by guards who take away the signs and stop them from communicating in that way. But they're doing what they can to get the story out, that they're very worried that they might have already been exposed, that the ICE agents working there aren't taking it seriously. We've heard many reports of areas that are not being sanitized, that there's very limited access to even soap, let alone anything stronger than that. And so if I were one of these women, I would be absolutely terrified about what would happen if it turns out that it was coronavirus and that other people might have been exposed to it.
Yeah, I mean, this is ICE is just a group of jackbooted thugs, like just Trump's brown shirt brigade. The way they treat undocumented people is so inhumane and callous and archaic. It's reprehensible to think about that this is something that we allow willingly in our country. You know, my heart goes out to people who are in these situations, because 99.999% of them who try to come here or are seeking refuge from violence, from cartel violence, from, you know, spousal abuse, they are here because they want a better life. They pose us no harm, no threat. They just want to be part of our country and contribute as best they can. And now, in a time of global crisis, they're treated like subhuman. They are treated like dirt, and it's truly grotesque. This is something that I feared, many people feared, as this started to bubble up, as the pandemic started to grow, because you knew incarcerated people and undocumented people were going to be the last to receive care or be treated well. And I think this is truly a dark spot on our country right now. That this is something that people are turning a blind eye to. We have to be vigilant. We have to treat them as equal, as full human citizens, and just treat them with dignity, love, and respect.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I remember, this is probably about a week and a half ago, when one of the efforts that some, I believe it was governors at that point, were taking was releasing some people from prison, or being like the temporarily lockup, like if they were there, they couldn't pay their bail or whatever, releasing them so that you would alleviate some of the overcrowding. And I remember people like Tommy Lauren attacking that, saying like that it's ridiculous that at this time we're going to be like they they want to see these people packed in there. Like, anytime anyone advocates for them to save their lives, to extend the vote to them, Bernie Sanders got attacked that last year. The idea is, no, they have trespassed and they have no rights whatsoever. Any suffering that they have to deal with, that was their choice when they broke the law, however unjust that law might be. And now, like, hypothetically, we're still at the beginning of this. We could help these people, but it doesn't look like that help is going to come. I don't remember a lot of discussion during, you know, in the Senate about how we're going to protect these people, especially when, like, this facility where the women were run by a GEO group, private prison corporation. So if they can protect these women and make less money doing it, is that something that they're going to do? Nothing about the GEO group, from my experience, leads me to believe that they're going to do that. And so, like, people are going to die as a result of this. They're going to get sick. Some are going to die. We're not necessarily even going to know, because what, we think that they're shipping massive amounts of coronavirus testing kits to these places? Like, people are going to die of this sickness, and they're never even going to be added to the numbers. Their story is being silenced right now, but even the tragedy that befell them will be silenced in the end.
Right. And it's important that, you know, people like you in this show and people like The Intercept and even Ken Klippenstein at The Nation has been doing a great job on this as well. For independent reporters and progressive reporters to follow this story the entire way, because like you say, they will absolutely be erased. So we cannot let that happen, because their life matters, their experiences matters. Like, we cannot ignore them. They have to be treated with dignity. This is so inhumane. We're seeing the tests, you know, rich people, like celebrities, politicians, athletes, they were getting tests like weeks ago when no one else could get a test. People who weren't showing symptoms but were wealthy were getting tests. And if you know, me, the American citizen, can't get a test, you can't get a test, they're definitely, people, undocumented people in ICE custody are absolutely not getting tests. So this, and cramping them in there, you know, obviously defies CDC guidelines. It would incubate and expedite the spread if someone were to be infected. This is extremely dangerous. And like you say, lives could be lost as a result.
Exactly. Yeah. And I feel like if we found out that, like, you know, Gavin Newsom said, you know, we're going to take 10,000 tests, and we're going to make it available to these prisons to limit the spread. Like, imagine how they would be attacked, probably by Trump as well. He would use, you know, 5 minutes at one of his press conferences to attack them for wasting tests on prisoners. I have a feeling he would do that. Democratic primary continues. Bernie Sanders obviously interested in continuing not only to contest this thing, but also to share the stage, digital, if not physical, with Joe Biden and contrast himself with Joe Biden. Bernie was on with Seth Meyers recently, and he was asked about where this primary is likely to go. Let's listen.
Do you still see a path to the nomination? Obviously, you're behind the delegates. It looks like a very hard path. And if not, why are you remaining in the race?
Well, we're about 300 delegates behind. Biden has 1,200. We have 900. There is a path. It is admittedly a narrow path. But I would tell you, Seth, that there are a lot of people who are supporting me. We have a strong grassroots movement who believe that we have got to stay in order to continue the fight, to make the world know that we need Medicare for all, that we need to raise the minimum wage to a living wage, that we need paid family and medical leave, one of the crises that we're dealing with right now, that we must address climate change and education, all the issues that we have been talking about. Campaigns are an important way to maintain that fight and raise public consciousness on those issues. So that's, I think, one of the arguments for going forward.
So, Jordan, there he was asked by Seth Meyers, do you believe that there is a path forward? And if not, why are you staying in this? And Bernie says that, you know, obviously it is a narrow path, but a path delegate wise does still exist. And even if it didn't, he listed some of the major differences he has policy wise with Joe Biden and his desire to continue to contrast himself with that. I'm interested in checking in with you. I mean, we've had an experience of Joe Biden for the past couple of weeks of his struggle to sort of adapt to the new environment. What do you think about the future of this Democratic primary? How do you see this playing out?
This primary is getting really weird just because of everything. You know, at you saw how your viewers saw how you and I struggled with technology. Now we have they're trying to run an entire, you know, Democratic presidential nomination campaign on the same technology. So it's pretty interesting to watch. But I think a lot of people need to understand that Sanders' perspective, and he wrote about this in his book, Our Revolution, it became clear he was not going to beat Hillary in the primary. He saw that as a moment to help shift the platform left. And what people need to understand is at the convention in the summer, they devise a formal platform. And Sanders was, you know, his mission was to help get some of his ideas into that platform. So I think he's just going to do the same thing. And I think he's been extremely cautious and not trying to kneecap Biden. He's not trying to go low. You know, we saw some pretty stark contrasts drawn between him and Biden in the last debate. And I think these are important because when we don't have a challenge to the front runner or the presumptive nominee, it's very easy for them to coast and not really understand what the growing demands are, you know, not be mindful of uniting the moderate wing and the progressive wing of the party. So, you know, this is his perspective and his approach. And I think it's a totally normal and fine one. And people, I think, should be more agreeable and, you know, on board with it.
You know, I couldn't agree more with you about the coasting. Like, I would describe Biden over the past 2 weeks as at best coasting. Now, with the challenge continuing, with debates potentially in the future, you know, with primaries in the future, does anyone watching this, and I know that there's probably some of you who are enthusiastic Biden supporters, do any of you think that Biden would be fighting harder if Bernie had already backed out? If Bernie endorsed him, if Bernie was fighting to get him elected right now, would Biden be doing, you know, an extra 2 minutes a day of media hits? Like, what would Biden actually be doing? What is Biden doing now? This primary has become so, it started off very exciting once we got into the actual voting for obvious reasons, and it has become incredibly frustrating because we are saddled with a candidate who in some ways, I would say objectively, I think in some ways is better than Hillary Clinton. But in other ways, like, nobody doubted that Hillary Clinton wanted to become president. She clearly wanted it. She'd wanted it for a very long time. It's a very different question of whether she deserves it. But she certainly wanted it. Joe Biden seems like he just decided one day that he was going to run. And he kind of regrets the decision. And he doesn't really want to fight for it. But Super Tuesday just sort of turned things around for him. And he doesn't really understand it. It's very frustrating to watch when we have this emergency, which is making it so clear who we need as the candidate, that right now we have someone who instead is just sort of like, yeah, just hoping to just make it to election day and maybe squeak past the finish line. And that's about it. That's the most that I can expect from him right now.
Yeah, I think your point's a strong one. If Bernie had dropped out, Biden would not be adopting policy proposals from Warren and Sanders, or at least some of them. So I think it's important that at least someone stays in until they're mathematically eliminated. You know, sure, Sanders has a slim path to victory, but, you know, just, you don't drop out if you're losing in the seventh inning. You just play through the end. You never know what could happen. And I do think there could be a moment where people warm up to the idea of Medicare for All, because this, we're now going to see tens, if not over 100 million people lose their private health insurance. Like, we could see a huge catastrophic drop off in healthcare coverage. And what is there to catch them? You know, the ACA marketplace, which is notoriously unaffordable. That's it. I mean, maybe you could apply for Medicaid. But, you know, there isn't a robust safety net. And when Joe Biden's healthcare plan, the alternative is leaving 10 million people uninsured and protecting this system, I don't know how you're going to get people enthusiastic about it. So this is a moment, and Sanders and the campaign have been doing a great job of centering healthcare and healthcare policy in the discussion through the repeated live streams, having healthcare professionals, having legislators and lawmakers on repeatedly, talking to people directly about issues that impact them. I think that's a great approach.
Yeah, and thankfully he's been doing that for a very long time. Like, imagine if you had been talking for literally years about the need to set up a system that would protect people if things fall apart. And then during the election, things fall apart. And like the guy that you're running up against is like, yeah, we need to like marginally improve things. Maybe. Yeah, maybe 10 million people still won't have health insurance and premiums will continue to spike. Like God only knows what they're going to be like next year after all this, after all the costs associated with coronavirus. And that's just another emergency that I guess we'll deal with at that point. You know, we're not going to do anything big. We're not doing anything fundamentally to change this. Like it's madness that this isn't like the race should have turned on a dime as soon as the coronavirus hit, as soon as people saw how vulnerable the system has made them. The fact that it hasn't, like that is very frustrating. I know that people are obviously rightfully distracted about, you know, how crazy things are. But they should be like, they should realize the choices that are being presented to them, the option that they have right now. Many of them, there are more than enough states that'll still vote at some point that hypothetically this thing could turn around. And I think you're right. People should wake up about Medicare for All. This is the perfect opportunity for it. This is this is a crucial opportunity. It feels like, at least in the near term, this is the last opportunity for them to wake up about it. And I hope that they do.
Yeah, I do too. And you know, people like Rashida Tlaib and Pramila Jayapal, Ilhan Omar, AOC, they've been really hammering this point over the past couple weeks. They've really been using this moment to highlight the inadequacies of the private healthcare system in the United States. You saw the story, the tragic stories of a teenager who didn't have health insurance was turned away, and then he died, and he had coronavirus. What kind of system is that? Like, that's profoundly broken. Like, why would anyone accept that? Like, why shouldn't that person in a global pandemic get treated for, you know, what, you know, for coronavirus? It's mind boggling. You almost have to laugh because it's just so insane. I can't believe that people are just letting this happen. And again, I think it just ultimately when it's going to take that virus infecting someone close to them, I think, for people to finally get on board and understand that, you know, it doesn't discriminate based on income level or political affiliation or where you live or what you look like. It's just, it can impact anybody. And we need to just treat everyone as equal in healthcare delivery.
Yeah, I feel I want to go to the Capitol and I want to just run down the hallways banging on doors like, do you get that people have to pay rent tomorrow? And like, God knows how many millions have lost their jobs. Do you get that the homeless community is going to be absolutely devastated by this? Do you get that Rikers is going to be like, would you be shocked to find out in 2 weeks that 100% of the prisoners at Rikers have coronavirus? Like, would anyone be shocked by that? Is anyone in government talking about that? Let alone all of the ICE detention facilities. And you're right, by the way. The Intercept is doing great work there. Everyone follow Ken Klippenstein at the Nation. He's doing great work there. It's like there's the emergency, and then there's all of these other emergencies that nobody in power seems to recognize or have any inclination to deal with. The emergency they seem to be focused on is the fact that the stock market fell apart, and they think that they can fix that. Maybe. Some seem to think we should sacrifice millions of lives to do it. Some think we should just bail out all the corporations. But they're all focused on solving that problem. But there are so many other problems that are going to cost so many lives. And very few people, Ilhan Omar, you know, Bernie, AOC, Rashida Tlaib, a few recognize that. And that seems like really the extent of it at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, sadly. You mentioned the homeless community. This is just... I don't know if you saw this picture, but hopefully some of your viewers did. There was a picture in Nevada where some local authority or agency had painted lines on a parking lot, John, and told the people experiencing homelessness, here, just sleep in these lines on this concrete slab in this parking lot so you can observe social distancing. In Las Vegas, a city with now thousands of empty hotel rooms, just a couple blocks away. Even in a time of global crisis, people are still unwilling to treat people experiencing homelessness as full humans. Unbelievable.
Yeah, the government could pay to put them up in the hotels and have food shipped to them. Like, to make them sleep on concrete. And I looked at that picture. I don't even think those spots are 6 feet apart. I don't even think that would do literally anything. And if you're in the middle of it, you have to be stepping over. It's worse than doing nothing, because it implies that you recognize that there's a problem, but your solution won't protect people and kind of spits in their face at the same time. It's worse than disinterest. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It's an industry that the hospitality industry in Las Vegas is just so predatory and corrupt. I mean, just like it's just built around taking your money and bankrupting people, and the system is completely rigged. And even in this moment, they still can't afford to be even just slightly generous to like help these people out. Just so cruel.
Breaking news this morning, Chris Cuomo of CNN, the latest high-profile figure in America to apparently come down with coronavirus, which he let us know about on Twitter with this message. So, in these difficult times that seem to get more difficult and complicated by the day, I just found out that I am positive for coronavirus. I've been exposed to people in recent days who have subsequently tested positive, and I had fever, chills, and shortness of breath. I just hope I didn't give it to the kids and Christina. That would make me feel worse than this illness. I'm quarantined in my basement, which actually makes the rest of the family seem pleased. I will do my shows from here. We will all beat this by being smart and tough and united. And so, look, a famous person, a person in media getting coronavirus is no more important than any individual. But for anyone who gets it, I feel terrible. It was kind of a funny way that he spread it to everyone, but obviously, you know, hope that he recovers and that his family wasn't exposed to it.
Yeah. I hope he's okay. I hope no one else got it. But yeah, you know, again, like we said earlier, it doesn't discriminate. It could impact and infect anybody. So we need to be mindful. We need to practice social distancing. And it was probably tough for him. I think he probably had to go into the studio up until recently. I know CNN has transitioned to broadcasting from home. And it's so interesting to see, circle back to where we started with, it's so interesting to see who can handle this transition. TYT's doing a pretty good job overall. I think maybe some hiccups here.
Well, the beginning of this stream wasn't a great example of it necessarily, yeah. but we're doing okay. We're doing okay.
I hope he's okay. I hope Chris is okay.
Yeah, exactly. And when I first saw this, an article about him being infected, I just I did like the share to Twitter thing, and it spread it out. And a bunch of people were like, you know, like implying that it's good or whatever, and like, okay, if that's your response to someone getting coronavirus, unfollow me on Twitter. Like, don't reply to my tweets if you think it's good. I don't want anyone to get coronavirus. I don't want anyone to die as a result of this. I thought we were all unified by that thought, but apparently no. And in particular, like, I'm going to try to appeal to some people who are probably fundamentally irrational. Yeah, I get. He works for CNN. CNN's got a lot of issues. I don't agree with Cuomo on a lot of things. He does bring progressives on his show. And I think he tries to keep an open mind on a number of different topics. And those two things are not something that all people on CNN or MSNBC do. So maybe let's try to be a little bit nicer and recognize that this is a human who is sick and is worried that he might have spread it to his family and that his family might get sick or possibly die. Let's have a little bit of empathy, I would say.
Yeah, I read the room, folks. Not really the time to cheerlead. It's, you know, people don't want to be edgelords. That's their choice, but... you know, just you would hate it if one of your friends or family members got it. You know, extend the same empathy to other people.
Exactly. Well, one last thing on the watching all the shows adapt to this. Do you watch John Oliver at all? Did you see his most recent one from home?
I don't.
It looks pretty good. Sounds pretty good. I don't know if you've seen Trevor Noah's shots. I don't know what camera they gave him, but it is more beautiful than the actual studio footage. Like, they need to bring that camera from his house to the studio the next time they shoot. Yeah, some people are doing a great job. Seth Meyers, the first couple shows, his audio was was so bad.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's like, I know you got equipment. I know it's tough, but, well, I shouldn't talk about audio issues after today, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, well, Jordan, thank you so much for joining me and for sticking through a very difficult first 10 minutes. I really do appreciate that and everything you're doing during this. You know, obviously, I follow you not only in our DM groups, but also your activism and your social media activity. I really do appreciate it. So thank you for everything you're doing.
Thanks, John. And thanks for having me.
Anytime you want to come on, we're always going to have a spot for you.
Appreciate it.
I am very excited to welcome back to the show Congressman Ro Khanna. Congressman Khanna, as always, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. So thank you for making time for the show.
It's always great to be on.
As I was saying before we went live, I can only imagine how busy you are. There's been a lot of activity over the past few weeks to come to put together some sort of response to the coronavirus pandemic, a relief bill. Some bills have now passed. I'm curious from your point of view, how you would rate so far the government's response to this pandemic.
Well, it's a start, but not nearly enough. One-time checks of $1,200 is not going to cut it. People need relief for at least 6 months to be able to make living expenses. Also, we need a moratorium on rents, a moratorium on mortgages. There are small businesses, restaurants that are going out of business. People are facing defaulting on their rents, the threat of losing their homes. So we need to have that protection. Also, there needed to be a lot more safeguards on the $500 billion that have been handed out to these large companies. If we were going to give them loans, the government should have gotten a guaranteed equity, and that money should have been directed to keeping people employed. There were not those restrictions, and I fear that money is not going to the people who need it the most.
Yeah, and of course, there were some safeguards that were set up, but in his signing statement, Donald Trump made clear that he did not feel bound by those, and it's possible that at least in the near term, Steve Mnuchin is going to have a lot of singular power over where that money goes. I know that Representative Ocasio-Cortez, she mentioned how difficult the position that she and other progressives were put in, where they want to provide relief for the American people, and you rightfully point out some communities that are still being left behind. And yet there's this huge sum of money. So what do you do in that position? Do you feel like your arm is being twisted into supporting some things that you don't agree with?
Yes, in candor. I mean, there wasn't a roll call vote, but I would have voted yes because the alternative was catastrophic. I mean, how can you not at least get loans to small businesses, to restaurants, to dry cleaners so that they don't have to lay off folks? How can you not at least get $1,200 to people making under 75,000 or about almost $3,000 for families up to 150,000 who have two kids. I mean, obviously, these are things we needed to do. But the Senate held hostage this entire bill for the $500 billion of demands from industry. Now, I wish we would have gotten more commitments up front to that this wouldn't just be going to corporate profits and that the government would be getting some equity. But it was a very, very hard situation, as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez pointed out.
And the safeguards that do remain over that money, do you feel like, I mean, I'm assuming your colleagues are probably gearing up for what's going to be a difficult year or two or longer of oversight to make sure that money is being passed out where it needs to be, that there's not any sort of insider trading going on. That's been a concern recently. Some in the Senate already appear to potentially have profited off of the confidential information they have. Are you worried about the possibility that this money could be doled out in a way that's intended to benefit, you know, people connected to those doing the doling as opposed to the actual need?
I am, because there was, again, no specification of how it's being used. I mean, look, Canada, Denmark, Great Britain, they have a policy where the government is supporting paying for a percent of the payroll. And I wouldn't have had a problem with that if you're talking about some of these companies needing to meet payroll and are asking for government's assistance to do that, then you know at least it's not going to be misused. But when you basically have wide latitude to do things that they claim are in the business interest to stay solvent, that gives too much flexibility to give pay to executives, CEOs, to not be doing things that are in the interest necessarily of workers or the taxpayers. And I do have significant concerns on that.
You mentioned earlier that people just tomorrow are going to have to be paying rent. Millions are going to be doing that after losing their jobs in the past few weeks. And so that's one group that so far I haven't heard much talk outside of you and a few other good progressives. I haven't heard much talk about. There's a lot of concern about how coronavirus is going to hit the homeless population, the undocumented population, people in ICE detention and prisons and things like that. Do you feel like some of those communities will be addressed in the next round of legislation? Where do you think these next steps are going to go?
They need to be. I mean, the moratorium on rent payment is a big deal. I mean, there are people in my district, immigrant families, some of them who've spent years, decades, having a small business, having a restaurant, having a dry cleaner, having a chain Jack in the Box, or having some kind of services business, and they can't make the rent, and they will lose everything that they've worked for. That's just wrong, and we can easily fix this with having a moratorium on rent for businesses and and individuals. And then, you know, the homelessness issue. We need to have temporary shelters that have medical services. We need to make sure that everyone is covered on healthcare. I mean, we're realizing quickly in this country that we're only as safe as the least insured. And you know what's happening, actually? There's some people who are more affluent who suddenly have lost their jobs because this crisis hasn't just affected the working class. And suddenly they're without health insurance. And now they're realizing, wow, the system doesn't really work. And maybe we should have had single payer. So I think this moment is getting a lot of people to reconsider what we need in this country for a safety net.
So as I'm not in D.C., obviously, I'm holed up in Los Angeles. I'm trying not to leave my home as much as possible. So I can't say I'm trying. So I don't know what's happening in the halls of Congress. But as an outsider, it has felt like Donald Trump is just barely starting to act like he gets how bad this might become by the end. The willingness to sort of slow roll legislation from Mitch McConnell and many in the Senate implies to me that they might not take this as seriously as it looks like it's going to be. Obviously, you have much more personal interaction with these people. Do you feel like your colleagues really get that this could result in the deaths of tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands or more Americans, that real drastic structural solutions need to be put into effect? Or are they still thinking that this is something that we're going to be done with by Easter or maybe a few weeks after that?
I think people get the urgency, but they don't get fully the science. I mean, it's shocking to me that I am the only member of Congress who has actively called for a national shelter in place. There were 20 colleagues who signed the letter, but I had a tough time getting Democrats to sign my letter to the president. And any scientist, any person who specializes in infectious disease will tell you that what we need is a national shelter in place for at least 2 weeks. It may be longer. And so I think that the sad thing is that we are not doing everything we need to do to minimize deaths.
Yeah. I've been watching as Bernie Sanders has been responding to this. Obviously he's been very equipped and talented in terms of digital communication for some time. But instantly the transition over to sort of digital town halls, digital, like getting doctors and experts in and talking with them. What do you think about some of what he's called for? He very early on laid out like three principles for what should guide the government response. What do you think about his approach to dealing with the pandemic?
I think his policies now are seen as needed by a large chunk of the country. I mean, he's been saying that we needed healthcare for everyone before the pandemic. And now when millions of people are losing their job, they see the need for that. And by the way, it's not just let's get tested for COVID-19 or let's get treated for COVID-19. What about the millions of other people who are going to be uninsured and suddenly don't have healthcare? Don't they need healthcare? Don't we want to keep them healthy so that they're less exposed to COVID-19 or can recover if they were exposed? So his response there about extending at least temporarily Medicare for everyone is spot on. He has called for the vaccine being free. I can't believe you even have to call for those kind of things. He said that the treatment should be free. He has said that we need a moratorium on rents, that we need to get money into the hands of people, not just on a one-time basis, but for nearly a year so that people have time to recover. So I think what this crisis has shown is that the fragility of our economic system. There are those of us who have the opportunity to work remotely in the comforts of our home. And yes, we are also at risk and our families are at risk, but it's a different view than those who are still having to go to work because they need the paycheck, who are struggling to get health insurance. And this crisis has just highlighted the economic disparity that Sanders has been warning us about.
Yeah, it certainly seems like if if more and more people are accepting that they should not, you know, become infected with coronavirus or die of coronavirus because they can't pay for it, that it's not that huge of a leap to say, well, then why should I die of diabetes or heart disease or respiratory illness or a million other things? And so I too feel like this might be a moment where people will wake up to this. I'm curious if you've seen any indication that maybe some of your colleagues who haven't necessarily been supportive of Medicare for All or any form of single-payer healthcare, if they might sort of get that we would have been far better positioned to weather this pandemic if we already had a system like that in place, if people's health insurance was not tied to their job in a time when millions of people are losing those jobs. Do you see any sign of that?
I haven't seen it yet with colleagues. Now, candidly, we've been all focused on the immediacy of the stimulus and coronavirus. So I don't think those conversations have taken place. But where I have seen it is with people in my district, some of them more affluent, some of them engineers, professionals, who never thought they would lose their health insurance, suddenly vulnerable, suddenly having to navigate a health system that is way too complex, and they're understanding it.
Congressman Ro Khanna, we really appreciate any time you can make for us, and you know, good luck in pushing your colleagues in the right direction in this response to the pandemic. There's a lot of people that desperately need the help.
Thank you, and I would just say that you know, I know there was a cheap shot about Italy being single player. Italy's problem was capacity, but when you look at South Korea and other countries that have had single payer, they've done very, very well.
Yeah, 100%. Couldn't agree more. Thank you, Representative Khanna.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.